Okay. Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank Soil Science Society of America for inviting me here, and Sabine. What I'm talking about, I guess, is motivated by our interest in soil carbon these days, and I think our interest in soil carbon has two bases. One is as a potential mitigation for greenhouse gases, but also the realization that improving soil carbon is probably a good thing for soil structure, food security, and everything else. So it's a kind of win-win, and that's why we're interested in it. And I'm also interested in spatially predicting carbon and doing work on carbon auditing to prove that you can actually sequester carbon on farm. So that's kind of the basis. I have a particular philosophical position these days in the pedometrics area, which is to try and do things which are reasonably practical, pragmatic, and so on. So how can we look? How much carbon have we got? So at the moment, Buddy and I are writing a little review about digital mapping of soil carbon. These are a few of the studies that have been done in terms of grid spacings, extents, and sampling density. And so I'm talking today about regional estimation of carbon and change. So we're talking about resolutions of 50 to 500 meters, data densities of 1 to 100th or per square kilometer, and extents of 1,000 to 100,000 square kilometers. We're not talking about farms or little fields on farms or this kind of thing. So it's more of the regional extent. At the end, I'll say a little bit more about bigger extents, but that's what we're talking about. The basic model that we're using for most of the work that we're doing at these resolutions and extents is the Scorpan model, which is just some kind of rewriting of Yeni, which is some kind of rewriting of Zakharov. But realizing that this is a prediction model, so soil itself can predict soil. I don't know if soil can beget soil, but soil can predict soil. And there are a few factors in there. And when it comes to carbon, obviously climate, land use through organisms, and topography have quite a part to play in any model that you might have that will predict carbon. And so we have various kinds of sources. Just wanted to quickly run through one issue. When you come into the auditing, soil carbon auditing world, we move from estimating concentrations to estimating stocks, the amount of carbon per unit area to some depth, or the amount of carbon per unit volume. So therefore you need not only to know the carbon concentration, but you also need to know the bulk density, which is much harder to estimate, probably has more uncertainty in it. There's another problem, though. If we consider this, if we consider, so what people doing stock estimates would suggest is that you do it to a fixed depth. But if you've got any kind of tillage operation or shrinkage or swelling, then if you consider this soil here, and then you have a tillage operation, it would actually rise by this much. Then if you did this to a fixed depth, you'd effectively lose carbon without any change in carbon. So the stock would actually change. So without getting into too much detail, we would suggest, rather than plotting against depth, we would suggest plotting against another coordinate, which is the cumulative mineral mass, and this is a so-called Lagrangian coordinate, and this was first suggested for swelling soils and soil water by Smiles and Rosenthal in 1968. I have to say, This is work from the University of Sydney. So what we are suggesting now for stock estimates is to actually report the amount of carbon to a fixed cumulative mineral mass, which might be 400 or 1200 kilograms per square meter. So that's just a little aside, but I think it's an issue. There's a thing called equivalent soil mass, but that's not the same as the distal Lagrangian coordinate. So when you're doing the geostatistics of this, you've got an interesting third dimension to deal with. That was just a little aside. Anyway, first of all, 2D estimation. So basically, this is really about carbon concentration. So here we've got an area of northern New South Wales. For those of you who know, this state here is New South Wales, and it is 1.09 times the size of Texas. So just so you know, for any Texans in here. So basically here we're modelling carbon, and if we know the bulk density, we can go from, and using this kind of Scorpan model, we can make a model of carbon, and I can't find me, oh there it is. We can convert that to carbon density, if you like, kilograms per square metre to 10 centimetres or whatever. Okay, so we can do that. So how do we go, but the problem these days is, you know, one depth is not really what we're after. We're after knowing what the carbon is at multiple depths or multiple cumulative mineral masses or whatever. So how do we go from 2D to, you know, not quite 3D, but something like 2¾ dimensions or something? The first way we tried to do that is that a lot of people realise that carbon decreases in concentration from the soil surface. So we first of all try to do it using, and we have published this, using a negative exponential depth function. And so we have a whole set of covariates, these Scorpan variables. We have a negative exponential depth function. So we model the parameters of that function as a function of the covariates, map those across space. So effectively you should be able to have the carbon concentration at any X, Y, and Z depth. And so these are the three parameters of the exponential depth function. So one that describes the lower concentration, one that describes the sort of asymptotic concentration or the difference between the two, and one that describes the rate of change of the carbon with depth. But as we all know, not all soil profiles show nice, uniformly, monotonically decreasing exponential depth functions. So we moved on to something that's a bit more flexible. So we use now the equal area quadratic spline function. And there's going to be a talk about that this afternoon. More detail will come. But the idea of that is you have some data of this kind, which might represent the horizons of a typical pedological description. And then we say, well, what does a carbon distribution look like? So we fit a spline like that. What's the property of this spline? It's quadratic at all between the joining points, but it's equal area in the sense that for each of those places where we have a depth increment measurement, the area, if you like, to the left of the curve and to the right of the curve is the same. So it's an equal area mass preserving spline. So you preserve the amount of carbon that's actually in the profile, and that's the best fit. So now we map for fixed depths, and these represent the parameters of the spline. We map those across space as a function of our Scorpan variables. And so I'm just going to talk about this area of Edgeroy up here. And from doing that and fitting it to pedological type data, we can get an estimate of the carbon concentration in these different depth increments. And at any place, because we've got estimates of that, we can reconstruct what the carbon content distribution looks like at any place across the area. And we can also do some conversions and do that in terms of carbon density and cumulative soil mass, so we can figure out, by knowing the bulk density, we can figure out where we might get to 400. If that was a reference point, 400 kilograms per square meter, we would know that that represented around 5 or something kilograms per square meter. The reason why it's important in this area is that most of this area is like, from here down to the coast, it's actually cracking clays, vertisols, so they do swell and shrink. And so we can do the same thing. Obviously, this soil's got much less carbon in it. So we can do it both ways. So we can map out the depth at which the cumulative soil mass equals 400 kilograms per square meter, or the carbon density at the cumulative soil mass of 400 kilograms. So you can see that that varies from 28, the first one from 28 to 49 centimeters, and this one varies from 1 to about 20. The high areas here are native forests that have never been cleared. Out here, the low values represent our vertisols, which are under continuous cotton production. And we can get uncertainty estimates from that. Now, we could do it in a nice formal geostatistical way, but we've come up with a kind of empirical way of doing that by mapping the uncertainties as a function of the covariates by using some observations of uncertainties at certain places and mapping across that across the space. We use this approach because the models that we use for the predictions are quite non-linear, quite difficult to model, I think, formally. But it's an approach, and it gives us prediction limits for our predictions. Sorry, I should go backward. Oh, it's going forward. Okay. Can I go back? No. Yes. And we would get prediction intervals for our predicted spline, which are fairly wide here, as you can see. Just a bigger area, so we're talking about doing this whole area here. And the motivation for this work here is to be able to audit carbon on individual farms. But to do that, we need to have a prior estimate of carbon across the area. So all the red dots on this map represent data that we have. We're doing three biogeographic regions. It's about 150,000 square kilometres. And you can see the land use within that. And this will be appearing in EJSS. We have a whole raft of covariates here. What are particularly useful and interesting here are all the climatic variables, the gamma radiometric variables, potassium, uranium, thorium, which we always find useful, and some land use variables here, which we have very good land use time series data for the whole of Australia these days. All of this data here is available for the whole of Australia, so that's why we use that. And we use a program called QBIS to do this. It produces these rules. So it's a regression tree, but the nodes of the tree are not a single value, but they're actually a regression equation. So down at the bottom, you get a regression equation. And if you want to, you can map out where these rules occur, because there's some information in that. I won't go into that today. But you can see here that things like gamma radiometric thorium, rainfall, lithology come out quite often in these rules. So there is information in these rules. And that's just to do the splitting, and then you can see things like monthly temperature, maximum monthly temperature, are actually doing the predictions. And we'll come back to how that's actually useful to us later on. So when you're doing this kind of work, when you look at these rules, it's good. It makes you feel good if they actually make some kind of sense as a scientifically. These are not black boxes, really. And you should play around with this a bit so you can start to see relationships that kind of make sense. So doing that, we can make predictions of carbon across that region. This is on a 250-metre grid. So this is 250-metre grid. We've fitted the splines to all the data, so we've got this for fixed increments all the way through the profile. That's a 0 to 10, 0 to 30, 0 to 50. Obviously, as you're going deeper, the averages are getting less and less, 0 to 100. So we've got that all over the area. What we actually want to do with this is to audit particular farms. So I won't go into that in any detail except to say what our methodology is to. So we're interested in this farm in here, okay, which is just one little farm in that huge area. But these regional predictions are too coarse for on-farm use. So this is the farm. That's that square there. So what we do now is we bring in finer scale information, particularly about land use on the farm, and a finer digital elevation model. And so given this extra information, and local environmental covariates, we can downscale that to that. So that's how we do that. Now we use this map here to stratify the farm for carbon change. So that's the basis for our methodology, because we believe in outcomes-based auditing, not practice-based auditing. That's not auditing, that's just guessing. What about mapping carbon change over a region? Well, we could talk about monitoring, and I won't go into monitoring because that's a whole topic in itself about how you design monitoring schemes. I guess it's the one principle there is that if you can go back to places where you've been before or close to, you do better than if you don't. But there's a danger in that if you're doing auditing, if farmers know where you've been and they can do special things in those places. So, and that's why in our methodology, our two samples that we take are independent in that sense. There's a penalty in precision by doing that, but there's a gain in transparency and so on. Or you can use legacy soil data for this purpose. So I won't talk about monitoring. This is just some work we did on data from Java, where soil samples have been collected since the 1920s and measured, and these are the data, and it's been collected on a sort of regional basis, so the supports are a little bit. Then we know there are samples within here, but we don't know exactly where they are within each of these administrative regions. But there's enough data there that we can get a pattern of how carbon's changing, and we can get an estimate of carbon stock change over the region. I guess the most interesting thing is when you look at it from a global point of view, carbon dropped until 1970, but it's actually been increasing. So even if there's climate change happening, the management practices in Java are actually resulting in an increase in carbon concentration. We found exactly the same result in South Korea, or sorry, the Republic of Korea. What about estimating change? Well, obviously, if we've got a map of carbon, we can use that as an initial condition for a dynamic mechanistic model, or we can play around with what I would call a static empirical model. And let's just talk about those two. So the simplest reasonable dynamic mechanistic model of soil carbon change is the Henang and Dupuy model from 1945, which is just this two-compartment model, and the things like Roth C and Century really and truly are based on this model. It's interesting, it was written in 1945, so it must have been, actually, the work must have been done during the war, interestingly. So basically you can apply that model. So on the left there we've got, say, I don't have a location map, this is part of Hunter Valley, just north of Sydney. It's one of our prime wine growing areas. And the areas in blue are actually remnant forests, so that's why they're high. I don't have the vineyards. But basically using that model and looking at land use change, so this is a land use change scenario. We've converted all the vineyards to unimproved pasture. It's highly unlikely to happen, but we can't sell our wine at the moment because Australian dollar's too high, so you never know. We would get a change in carbon like this if we used that kind of model. So we'd get some gains in carbon. That's using a dynamic simulation model, but the Scorpan model itself lends itself to doing this kind of thing, because if we read I had to go back and find this, I had to reread it. So basically, in that paper on digital soil mapping, we talked about partially dynamic scenario soil maps. So basically, if you're fitting SXY or SXYT as a function of covariates, and if we know of any of the partial differentials with respect to time, then we can project the map forward. It doesn't tell you exactly when you're going to reach that new equilibrium. It doesn't tell you, but it gives you some idea what might be the expected value if you change some of the covariates. And the covariates that we're interested in carbon are obviously the land, things that represent land use and things that represent climate, not things that represent, relief. We don't think the relief, variables are going to change much over time. So if we do it like this, then we can have dc by dt or do by dt, and we can project forward. So in this case, the first model was fitted as a function of relief and land use, and we only had four land use classes. We changed one of the land uses, and then you get a new value of carbon. And it's very similar, actually, to the one that you get from the dynamic simulation model in this case. So there's not much difference here. A better example, so that big area that we had where we had all the carbon, big regional area, so we saw in that temperature variable, climate variables were important. So let's imagine that we have a change in relative to 1990 levels and of mean annual temperature 0.6 to 1 degree and a drop in mean annual precipitation of, let's say, minus 3.5%. And that is the scenario. The scenarios look like this for New South Wales in terms of changes in, for high emission, which we will still be in Australia, these are the changes in mean annual temperature that we're expecting up to 2030, and these are the changes in mean annual precipitation. So these are decreases in mean annual. So because we have in that cubist model variables that represent mean annual temperature and mean annual precipitation, we can then model forward, and we can, so we're just going to deal with this small area here, and so this is what we expect the change from now to 2030. But because bulk density is also a function of carbon, we expect a small change in bulk density as well over that time, and so we expect a change in carbon stock of 5 tonnes per hectare over that small region. And that's the carbon stock loss. But of course, the trick here is, because you've got to change a loss in bulk density, and if you just do the 0-50 thing, you're going to have some new soil coming in at the bottom of your 50 centimetres, so you're going to gain some carbon, which is not really a gain in carbon, it's just because your reference is 50 centimetres. So we actually gain an extra 9 tonnes of carbon per hectare, so the net loss is 0.41 tonnes. So that's why I still say that the cumulative mineral mass is a better variable to use than depth for this kind of work. Across the world, we're working on this global soil project, and we are producing maps of carbon in various ways. So that's the US. That's the old map from Australia, which we're working on. This is South Korea, resolution of 90 metres, carbon stocks. This is Denmark. That's some recent work that was done this year. The state of Rio de Janeiro, and this work that my colleague Dr. Ode has done for the whole of Nigeria at 90 metres. And this is pretty much global soil map specification. So that's work that's been done this year. So my conclusions, there's a lot going on, and keep on mapping on. Thanks.